From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Sonoma County Sheriff Robert Giordano spoke with reporters of the at least 17 who've died in the raging wildfires in Northern California. 11 were in Sonoma County.
The devastation's enormous, and I imagine we can't even get into most of the areas. The 11 we found have been found for other reasons being in those areas. So when we start doing searches, I would expect that number to go up.
More than 3,500 homes and businesses have been destroyed. Thousands of evacuees are still in shelters. The sheriff is telling residents to head south because those still at home and in shelters are no way out of danger. The National Weather Service says strong winds will fan the flames tonight through tomorrow morning. Gabe Moline is online arts editor for KQED, but also a resident of Santa Rosa. He evacuated Monday morning with his wife, daughter, and cat. They came back after the winds died down to find the house escaped damaged, but now as we're hearing, those winds are going to surge back. He joins us by cell phone. Gabe, what's your sense of things now?
It is harrowing here in Santa Rosa. The winds are picking up again. There are new evacuation orders. There are whole swaths of the city that are packing up and leaving. We are not out of the woods here yet by any means.
And also you're concerned about, you know, your father's home, the home you grew up in. What's your sense of what's happening there?
My childhood home was originally a chicken coop that my dad remodeled and built onto room by room. That house is gone. Built a new house up in Wickiup from the ground up. That was encircled by fire, miraculously spared on Monday morning. And there's new fires in the area. We're really worried about that. Our entire family heirlooms and memories are in that house.
Yeah. By you saying the first house was burned?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, look, you're also seeing whole neighborhoods gone. What's the, you say harrowing. Tell us more about what the feeling is there now.
There's just a lot of uncertainty. I mean, yesterday was a day of learning about so many friends' houses lost. I can't even keep count. There's just a huge void up here.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I mean, the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat reports 3,900 people were looking for a place to stay last night. We're hearing accounts of a 100-year-old man and his 98-year-old wife who couldn't get out of their home. They perished. Look, we know you've been trying to keep yourself busy doing things. Like what? Like, what do you do?
We went to the shelters yesterday, the evacuation shelters at the fairgrounds and the vets building. Some shelters are just not accepting donations anymore. We said, what do you need right now? They said, we got a lot of people who want to take a shower and we don't have any towels. So we found a Walmart about 7 miles from here that still had towels, brought them back. You know, there was a crowd of people that just descended on them saying, thank you, thank you. We can finally take a shower. And then just checking in on people, making sure they're okay, making sure that they have what they need. We're sticking together here in Santa Rosa. That's the silver lining, but I hesitate to even call it a silver lining.
What do you do? Because your house could be next. These winds are so variable. But we should mention that authorities there are saying it could have been anything, a cigarette tossed out or a car backfire or a chainsaw spark, because the rain that finally came to this area that was so dry produced this dry vegetation, which then combined with the wind, which comes every season, is what whiplashed this. You know, what's that like to have? This is a gorgeous part of the world. What's that like to have that beauty turn on you?
There's nothing to describe it. I was driving in at midnight on Monday night, just got in at the airport, and coming over the crest into Santa Rosa, I saw the entire ridgeline glowing, this giant orange beam in the sky. And it looked beautiful and also terrible because I knew what it was.
Yeah. I mean, I know you're in the moment, like, is my house going to go if the wind switches? But are you also thinking ahead?
I am, but there's no real way to rebuild this. I mean, I have cherished stories for every square foot of this area. Places like the Luther Burbank Center, where I went to kindergarten, had my senior prom there. Everyone in Santa Rosa has been the concerts weddings there, Cardinal Newman High School, the Fountain Grove Round Barn. I mean, these are places that just can't be rebuilt. And it cuts across all lines. You know, Fountain Grove is the very wealthy area with business owners, developers, the city's movers and shakers and supervisors up on the hill. The Journey's End Mobile Home Park is a very low income, lots of elderly people. That is gone. Coffee Park is a real working class, middle class area. I mean, we've lost the giant mansion of the biggest developer in town, and we've lost Kmart, if that gives you an idea of how this cuts across class lines here.
Yeah. By the way, what's the air quality like?
Terrible. We need masks. They're handing out masks at the shelters. There's a lot of health threats with breathing this air. The air is really thick with smoke. People have painter's masks. Those aren't good enough. There's respirator masks, N95 respirator masks are really needed.
Yeah. Why don't you leave?
I don't mean to be all George Bailey about it, but this is my home. It's hard. I'm not going to leave until they force me to.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Yeah. Okay, Gabe Moline, online arts editor for KQED there in Santa Rosa, just keeping watch to see what will happen to his house. Fire not at all contained. Gabe, best of luck to you.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Just a terrible situation there. Well, in northwestern Montana, grizzly bears may be removed from the endangered species list next year, expanding the geographic range of animals that are no longer covered by federal protection. Grizzlies that live around Yellowstone National Park were delisted in July, but the debate rages on over the best way to manage these icons of the West. As Wyoming Public Media's Cooper McKim reports, several groups are still filing lawsuits to keep the grizzlies under federal management.
Paul Miller just got back from a 12-day hunting trip outside of Cody, Wyoming, with some friends.
Yeah, we went on a mountain goat and a bighorn sheep hunt. One guy drew both tags, and we archery hunted it for a couple days and then hunted sheep with a rifle.
Miller says he saw 15 grizzly bears on his hunting trip. It's still illegal to shoot the bears, but he's excited at the possibility of hunting one soon. Conversations about trophy hunting jump-started this past August after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service removed the grizzly from the endangered species list. Miller is one of many residents in Wyoming who say it's about time the animal was put under state management.
When you can go into one drainage and you don't travel more than, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles each way and you can find 20 or 15 grizzly bears, I'd say that it's time to manage them a little better because they're just thick and you're just asking for people to get hurt.
The grizzly bear was listed as an endangered species in 1975. 28 years later, population surpassed the recovery criteria set by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In 2007, the Yellowstone grizzly was delisted, but federal protections were restored following a lawsuit. Under federal management, many residents of Wyoming say there's too many bears coming close to town. Hunting is prohibited, and for some, there's this gut reaction.
It's our wildlife. It's within Wyoming's boundaries. We have a great team here that knows how to manage it, and doesn't need to have Big Brother looking over their shoulder.
That's Lee Livingston, a Park County commissioner and an outfitter, who does stand to benefit if hunting grizzlies is allowed. He's walking into the courthouse in downtown Cody. He thinks this battle is still a ways from being over.
I say a lot of folks are probably still holding their breath. Been there, done it, seen it. We're not going to say it's done until it's done.
In late August and early September, more than 10 groups filed lawsuits against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They argue the decision to remove the grizzly from the endangered species list is premature and could lead to the animal's decline. Livingston calls the litigation an act of desperation.
They're doing well, and now they're grasping at straws to litigate under anything they can find. And the latest round of litigation, I think, shows that.
But litigants say there's been a troubling drop in the Yellowstone bears population recently. More than 60 bears died between 2014 and 2016, they say. And with dwindling food sources, they argue it's not the time to take away protections, let alone allow hunting to begin. Chuck Neal, a longtime Cody resident, is disappointed by those who want to allow hunting, especially on the outskirts of grizzly habitat.
That's exactly the wrong attitude, and it will be guaranteed to stop recovery in its tracks.
Neil says the only way to properly recover the grizzly is to allow them to move and settle between different habitats, like in Glacier National Park. Neil says that means bears on the periphery of Yellowstone are the most valuable.
Because they are the ones that are pioneering out, trying to recolonize historically occupied contiguous habitat.
Neil says federal regulation has allowed grizzlies the safety of making a slow and steady rebound, but the work isn't done.
We are snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory because we are getting that close. We're getting close, and we're going to guarantee it's never going to take place.
Charles Preston has lived in Cody for 19 years. He's director of the Draper Natural History Museum here in Cody. And he says delisting the Yellowstone grizzly shouldn't be seen as a death sentence, but an opportunity.
This is the end of one chapter, that chapter of long-term protection and recovery that we should be celebrating. And it's the beginning of another chapter. And that chapter is management and conservation of the grizzly bears.
As for those lawsuits putting the bear back on the endangered species list, they could take years to resolve. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim.
President Trump heads to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania later today to pitch his plan to cut taxes. Yesterday, he was asked if he thought that passage of that tax plan might be jeopardized by his days-long Twitter feud with former ally, the Tennessee Senator Bob Corker.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so at all. I think we're well on our way. The people of this country want tax cuts.
This morning on Twitter, Trump claimed victory in his spat with the NFL and mused about challenging the broadcast license of NBC because they reported that he surprised advisors in July by proposing a tenfold increase in the nuclear arsenal. That's the meeting that allegedly led Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to call Trump a moron. Here and Now, political analysts join us now. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And what do you make of this? I mean, let's listen here to Fox News and Kellyanne Conway, the presidential advisor, speaking this morning, asked if Trump has confidence in his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson.
The truth is that he has confidence in his Secretary of State and his entire cabinet. They met yesterday for lunch. And they are in touch very closely, as you can imagine, as any president and secretary of state are. The president has made very clear the way he feels about his cabinet. This is a handpicked cabinet. But the president is also the ultimate decision maker here.
She said stories about palace intrigue are nonsense. Late last night, Trump tweeted about reports that his chief of staff, John Kelly, might be on his way out soon. And then there are rumors of a suicide pact of Tillerson, Kelly, and the defense secretary, Mattis, that all of them would leave if any one of them gets pushed out. Paris, what's going on?
It's what you call palace intrigue. And the media has been focused on it from day one.
We've lost a lot of members of the Trump administration since then, though, so sometimes these stories end up being true.
As it relates to the cabinet, they have not been true. And so you can go down to low-level or lower-level positions within the administration. But when you look at the cabinet, Kellyanne Conway was right. This is a hand-picked cabinet. The president selected the people that he wanted to be in the cabinet, and he's working—
We just lost the Health and Human Services Secretary, a week ago.
We did lose the Health and Human because the president felt that his resignation was warranted because of the issues that he was involved in. And so, you know, that was one out of many. And when you look at his relationship with the Secretary of State, look, there's a lot of things on the table the president understands. Iran, North Korea, Israel are just a few of them. And when you look at the relationship that he has with him and the relationship that he has with Ambassador Nikki Haley and the UN, the president has a good team that is advancing his agenda for the world.
And Jamal, I want you to comment on that take on what's going on right now in the White House. But also, Paris mentioned Iran. Trump, we know, is preparing to decertify the Iran nuclear deal. He's not repealing it. He's just not re-upping it, which means it gets kicked to Congress. This morning, House Foreign Affairs Chair Ed Royce, the Republican, said, as flawed as this deal is, I believe we must now enforce the hell out of it. Jamal, your take on what's going on?
Well, first of all, let's just pay attention to what Parrish just said a second ago, which is that the White House staff is as intimate to the president as anybody else is. And in the White House staff, we have seen the president lose his press secretary, his communications director, actually two communications directors, his chief of staff, and his national security advisor, who's under investigation for being in collusion with the Russians, as well as lying on his forms that he filed for his national security clearance. I think that that is turmoil inside of the Trump White House. And now you've got, yes, this Iran policy. The president is playing, it's reckless politicking. It's the kind of politicking that will get all of us killed, frankly, if it doesn't go the way it is that he is trying to make it go. So hopefully people in the Congress will keep us safe, and the president's troika of National Security Advisor, Defense Secretary, and Chief of Staff will also stand in the gap.
Cute choice of words, Jamal, with troika. But listen, at the end of the day, any assumption that the president doesn't want anything other than to keep Americans safe is really just it's shameful. We all know that this president is hell bent on keeping this country safe, and all of the people who go into the White House and the different federal agencies every single day are public servants on both sides of the aisle, especially the National Security Council, which has celebrated 70 plus years or at least 70 years, are patriots. And so the any assumption
except for
that the
National Security Advisor, who is under investigation by the Justice
Department. He's not our current National Security Advisor. So listen, we cannot make these false claims that the president or anybody in the administration are not focused on keeping the country safe. That is the number one mission, and we all know that.
But there are some who are worried about
it. I think that's totally uncalled for, and I think that your listeners are deserve
but,
something
but
better.
Senator
to
Cor-
say that the president to say that the president of the United States does not want to keep this country safe is ridiculous.
A Republican Senator Bob Corker is the one who gave that interview in the New York Times saying that he and other lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, are concerned. Does that not trouble you at all?
I think a lot of people say things for political gain. People said these things about President Reagan. People said these things about President George W. Bush. And there's no question that they wanted to keep this country safe. And when you're president, you have to make the tough decisions. Bob Corker has been in the Congress and the Senate. He was a former mayor for a very long time. He is a politician. And you can say different things in the heat of the battle. But at the end of the day, if he wants to get things done, if he wants to get things done for the people of Tennessee and for the entire nation, he is going to work with this president and work with the Senate to get some positive things done, especially as it relates to immigration reform and tax reform, and hopefully repealing Obamacare.
Jamal, let me ask you about that. Does tax reform now become imperiled because of this fight between President Trump and Bob Corker? He's only got 52 Republicans in the Senate, and he's not going to probably get much Democratic support for tax overhaul.
Bob Corker, when he announced that he was not going to run again, and let's be clear, I'm not sure he's playing politics here. He's not running for office. He's the only person in this conversation who is not running for office again. Bob Corker said that he was going to bow out because over the next 15 months, he was going to be called to do among the most important things he may have to do in service of his country, and he didn't want to have political considerations. I think he has also said, Bob Corker, I know he has said that he would not consider a tax plan that did not decrease the deficit, and it appears he believes this tax plan will increase the deficit. So I don't think Bob Corker should be counted on to support this president and his tax plan.
Okay. I want to ask about the Harvey Weinstein scandal. Jamal, I want you to respond to the criticism that Democrats took too long to criticize this Hollywood makeup producer, but also Democratic donor. More and more women coming forward. He's admitted he's got a problem and is getting counseling, but he's denying the most recent charges of not just harassment, but assault and rape. Did Democrats wait too long?
There are some Democrats who came out immediately. There are some Democrats who did take too long. I think this is one of those places where people feel, I'm sure, some tug of personal loyalty to someone who has been helpful to them in some way. And then they understand also that there's a personal disgust at someone who has done something that is reprehensible. And so what I think you've seen is people regaining their footing and coming back out and saying very forcefully, from the president, Barack Obama, to Hillary Clinton, to others, they found it reprehensible, and they are not going to stand by him, including lots of Democrats who have said such things.
But Paris, I was watching over the weekend on Twitter Donald Trump Jr. tweeting all about this, despite the fact that his father, the president, was caught on tape talking about grabbing women by their genitals. Should the Trump team really be talking all about what's happening with Harvey Weinstein?
There's no correlation between Harvey Weinstein and President Donald J. Trump, like at all. But I think the one correlation
we can
There's more parallels between Harvey Weinstein and Bill Clinton than there is with Donald J. Trump. And when you look at
Harvey Weinstein was caught on tape saying that he was touching someone inappropriately, and Donald Trump said that he liked to touch people inappropriately.
Then you can say that's the extent of it. But when you go, I think that the outcry from Hollywood and everybody else is that Harvey Weinstein had a long history of doing a lot more than making a statement on a recording, which is what you can still say the same about President Bill Clinton. But my point is this. Everyone was shocked and appalled that President Trump waited, quote unquote, too long to respond to respond in a forceful way when it came to Charlottesville. And you have the DNC and all of the donors on that side and these members of Congress who took money from the hundreds of thousands of dollars from this man, millions of dollars, and it took them, you know, to find the tug of their heartstrings or whatever Jamal was talking about. It took them that long to respond to this. If the shoe had been on the other foot and he had been a Republican, you would have seen a different response. And that's why the Trump campaign and the Republicans are sounding off about it, because there is a double standard when there shouldn't be. This is a Democrat problem. This is President Obama's problem. This is Hillary Clinton's problem. This is Senator Warren's problem. And it's a DNC's problem.
Well, but Donald Trump is all of our problem.
Well, he's the president, and he's trying to help make America great again. And tax reform will benefit you.
But Paris, just briefly, I take your point. I mean, Harvey Weinstein, from what he's even admitted to, a reprehensible, appalling, a big moment in, I think, American culture. But Margaret Hoover, the Democratic analyst, pointed out today on CNN, only two conservatives, Peggy Noonan and David French, came forward when Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly were charged, accused of harassment. All of Hollywood, just about, has condemned Weinstein at this point. So has Obama, Clinton. You know, they're lining up with the condemnation.
I think when you look at Fox News as a whole and everything that happened with that organization, there's no doubt that they managed that situation in a way that gave proper repercussions for the actions. And I think Republicans were uniform in denouncing those actions.
I think we can agree we have a problem with men in power. No, hold on.
We have a power. We have a problem with power. We have a problem with power. We have a problem with power. It's not just men.
Paris Dennard, Republican strategist. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist.
Thank you.
Leave it at that.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot. A lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at WBUR.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
World stock markets once again hit record highs today. And this morning on Twitter, President Trump took credit, saying the stock market has increased by $5.2 trillion since the election, a 25% increase. He also went on to argue that his proposed tax cut plan would grow the stock market even further, by leaps and bounds, he said. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And we know that the Dow has gone up. The stock market has gone up since President Trump was elected. But it also went up 140% during President Obama's years in office. But what do we know about the reasons for that? Can the president really take credit?
Well, I don't know. Here's a problem with stock markets, right? They're trying to predict the future. So I would say there's almost two distinct periods. There's this period, say, between the election itself, the outcome of the election, and then, say, between healthcare failure. And I think that there's an interesting piece here where investors really did believe that there was going to be a bunch of different things going on, not just an overhaul of the tax code, but infrastructure spending, regulatory reform, some say on what healthcare was. And as soon as that was called into question, all three of those things really uncertain right now, all of a sudden investors said, wait a minute, are companies making money? Is the economy growing? How's unemployment doing? And on all those three metrics, things seem to be good for stock investors. We are seeing strong performance, and the globe has also continued to strengthen. All in all, it's been a good time to be a stock market investor.
But what about the argument that President Trump is making that the stock market is doing very well, and therefore we need to have massive tax cuts.
Well, I'm not sure it's a therefore. I think that the stock market is doing very well. It has nothing to do with tax cuts. It's maybe a counterfactual, because if companies are doing so well, it's hard to argue that they're dying under the impact of the corporate tax code. That said, if we do get big changes and drops in corporate taxation, clearly that's good for stockholders. It's unclear whether it's good for the economy as a whole.
Speaking of taxes, Jill, I want to quickly ask about the repeal of the soda tax in Chicago. Cook County commissioners voted to roll back the tax after just 2 months. I wonder if this is just another example of how strong the soda industry is in fighting laws like this. They did the same thing in New York.
Yeah, a big victory. They're calling it Big Soda. I'd like to call it Big Bubbles. They did spend millions on advertising buys and lobbyists, political contributions. It's really hard also to make the case that you're going to push back against that. You know, public health doesn't have that kind of money. I'm sure that everyone has the best intentions to fight obesity. It's just really hard to do when you have a lobby as strong as the beverage industry.
One more thing. We learned today that Sears Canada is shutting down. What does that say about retail?
Well, it says a terrible thing about Sears, which is this is a company that was taken over by private equity and used borrowed money to take it over. They did not invest in stores. It has been struggling. It's been a few years now that it's been on this downward march lower. The Canadian division of Sears is separate from Sears Holding, but it doesn't augur well for the rest of the Sears organization. I think that what we know about retail is that it's not location, 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 but it's certainly type. It's e-commerce. We got great news from Walmart yesterday about the growth of their e-commerce sales. But brands like Sears, man, they're going to stay under pressure.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Take care.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Raul Campos from KCRW is back with us today. Hi, Raul.
Hola, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well, and great to have you here with some of the music that you've been listening to. Let's start with the musician Diego Garcia. This is his single, Don't Go.
Every time I try to forget her, it plants another seed in my mind.
Now, Diego Garcia is based in New York, raised in Tampa, but born in Detroit, so a little from all over the country. But tell us about him.
And Argentine roots. So, you know, he's one of those crooners. He used to be part of the group Elephant back in the day, and he was the lead singer to that. But that was a little more rockin'. And here, I think when he does his solo work, it's just a little more intimate, more love songs, and, you know, influenced by people like Jobim and contemporary crooners like Brian Ferry, Leonard Cohen, you know, just a bunch of different people.
You can hear that Leonard Cohen in this song, Don't Go. What do you like about it?
Again, you know, he's always about love songs. Like his previous album, Laura, was basically a dedication to his wife. And I can't wait to hear more. Right now, it's just the one single that we've heard that's been floated out. But he always has this kind of vibe where it's just about love songs. And, you know, whether it's someone or something, you know, he's a big environmentalist. So he's part of that crew, Conservation International, where he gets to hang with people like Bono and, you know, a bunch of other peeps.
Right.
But the music is just it's just love. Lovely. It's pretty. And I like that about him.
All right. Well, now to a musician that a lot of people know. That would be Beck and his song Up All Night from the album Colors.
When you quit the rhythm and words help make you cold. When they break it down, then this world is all you know. Hands up, you're working it. Time to get yourself together. When you call the dominoes fall, it's time to go. Now I feel
feeling so far away. I see the colors and all the kids going home. Night is crawling up to the day. I hear the birds ringing the sirens all singing. Just wanna stay up all night with you. Just wanna stay up all night with you.
So another example there of Beck creating a new sound for a new album. This is a total 180 from his last album, Morning Phase.
It's always, you know, I've called him the chameleon for years, and, you know, with the album title as Colors, I mean, it's perfect. But yeah, it's definitely a departure from albums like Sea Change and, like you said, Morning Phase. But this here's bringing a little more energy and, you know, kind of maybe going back to a little bit like Odelay and The Information, you know, where it's definitely more kind of like a party and an energy. And Up All Night is kind of, you know, telling where, you know, late nights out on stage and stuff like that.
And for those who don't know, by the way, Beck has a very interesting story. He grew up in poorer neighborhoods in L.A., was one of just a few white kids in his school, and got into breakdancing.
Yeah, he grew up in the Valley, and he actually got his start here on KCRW. I think we were the first people to play him.
I feel like he's the only one in that category of artists that got their start on KCRW.
There are many, but he's definitely one of those ones where it's like, oh, wow, he's gone on to, like, huge things. And he remembers KCRW. So whenever he's doing, like, a new album or something, he always makes time for us, which is really cool.
All right, well, now we have another music veteran, the DJ Cut Chemist, with rappers Chali Tuna and Hymnal. Here's the song, Work My Mind.
Work my mind at different spurts in time. We pollute evolution in pursuit of a dime. Wanna eat, gotta grind, so my thirst is blind. With no outlet for change, people burp with crime. But I disperse my rhyme, and the worst is fine. If I switch course, my line is a broken spine. No crisscross, the straight path I search to find. But I misinterpret the signs at the worst of times. And you
work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind and turn it around. You work my mind.
Why'd you choose this one?
Well, Cut Chemist, I've always been a big fan of his DJ work and his production. He's a phenomenal DJ. And whether he was with the band Ozo Motley back in the day, Jurassic 5 more recently, and they reunited, so they've been constantly touring and doing all kinds of stuff. But this is his first solo album in like 11 years or something like that. But this is more of a little departure from just the cutting and scratching that he's known for. And really, like, writing songs. He's playing guitar he's doing background vocals on a lot of the songs. So I'm really looking forward to being able to play more from it in the future.
It's interesting when artists decide to take up a new instrument. We were just talking to one of the people behind Poolside, who said it was quite a challenge to be able to sing and play an instrument at the same time, something he had not had to do before.
Yeah, and those the same thing. There are a couple of DJs, you know, and they were, you know, bedroom producers, and then you got to basically replicate the sound live on stage.
Yeah.
So it's just I think it's the next incarnation of what an artist is.
All right. Well, let's move on to the song $875. This is from the LA-based duo Deluxe. So Deluxe is described, and I don't think this could be any more of a perfect description, as post-disco dance punk. Tell us more about them.
Well, Deluxe, just like the duo Poolside that you were talking about, a couple of bedroom producers, and now they're into the third album, more disco songs about love, and that's exactly what it is, you know? And this track, $875, I asked him, like, what's the meaning of the title? And he goes, that was our rent when we first started. So we had to figure out how to scrounge up so this money to basically stay in the house, which had the studio in it, and be able to produce. And again, you know, a couple of guys that we've supported from day one and doing bigger and better things these days.
All right, we have time for one more song. This is Pain from the Philadelphia-based group The War on Drugs. And very timely that we play this right now because you can hear the Tom Petty influence there.
Totally. And I was able to see the War on Drugs a few days ago. They actually opened up with a cover of Tom Petty. They did a Time to Move On. They just kicked into it, you know, right off the bat. And it was just, everybody was like kind of tearing up. And just, you can feel just how much of an influence Tom Petty has been on the War on Drugs. People like, you know, Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, and so many others. But Adam, you know, you can hear it that he's really into this expression of like feelings and emotions and everything else that comes to a songwriter. I mean, he even talks pretty openly about his heavy anxiety that he suffers from, you know, and to be kind of in your head like that and still come out with songs like this, it's pretty powerful.
And some outlets are writing about the War on Drugs as the next torchbearers of rock. What do you make of that?
Well, I've gone to see them at little venues like the Troubadour or the Roxy here in LA, and now these guys are headlining the Greek, playing the main stage at Coachella. You know, they're definitely on a magical ride right now.
Well, some great new music in this DJ session. Raul Campos from KCRW, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Ronan Farrow's reporting yesterday in The New Yorker escalated the charges against Uber movie producer Harvey Weinstein laid out in The New York Times last week. Women told Farrow that in addition to the sexual harassment charges in The Times, Weinstein raped and assaulted them. The New Yorker also released a recording from a New York Police Department sting 2 years ago. Model Ambra Badalina Gutierrez said Weinstein groped her breasts the day before the recording. Then during the sting, he tried to lure her into a hotel room.
If you embarrass me in this hotel,
I'm not embarrassing you. It's just that I don't feel comfortable.
Honey, don't have a fight with me.
It's not nice.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything, I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now. And 1 minute, and if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can... Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
But you're used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on.
I'm used to that, groping her breast. It is disgusting and not a surprise to a lot of people. Editor Tina Brown is currently the president and CEO of Tina Brown Media Live. She wrote in an essay on her digital platform, Women in the World, about leaving The New Yorker to found Talk Magazine in 1998 with Weinstein and taking over Miramax's book company. She joins us now. And Tina, you say at that time, you were puzzled about book contracts that went to attractive women who couldn't write and deals that went to gossip columnists that, you suspected helped Weinstein kill these stories of harassment?
It was really a sort of web of co-opting, which is what he really was running, a very widespread favor bank that he would extend towards anyone that he felt might be a person capable of writing or broadcasting something negative about him. Mm. And it was very effective, actually. It was very difficult to see any piece about Harvey that wasn't a glowing piece. And, I mean, I used to admire the way he could literally turn black into white sometimes with a story that would be called in, you know, that he was trying to stop, you know, that was actually something that he'd done or something that he'd said, which was actually, you know, fairly reprehensible. Nice. And he would actually manage to get the story changed to being how he'd done something wonderful and philanthropic. It was quite amazing. He's very gifted at that, as we know, from the brilliant job he did with his films.
Well, you remind us that Weinstein hired Lisa Bloom, a pitbull feminist lawyer, to defend against these charges of harassment. She's the daughter of another pitbull, Gloria Allred. Then, as you write, it emerged that the Weinstein Company bought Lisa Bloom's book for a movie deal. You say classic MO.
Well, I'm not sure that I don't actually think that Lisa Bloom understood that that was what was classic MO. I think she in good faith sold her book to Harvey Weinstein to make into a film about Trayvon Martin. But clearly, in Harvey's mind, he knew exactly probably what he was doing, which is that here is this pit bull feminist lawyer who, you know, is the one who takes down people who have been accused of sexual harassment. And I need her on my side. And so he would be very long-sighted, actually, in his sense that there are people who could be dangerous long-term and that they needed, therefore, to be brought into the Harvey fold.
Yeah. Well, and Lisa Bloom did quit defending him. Her mother, Gloria Allred, was appalled that she was. Look, Tina Brown, we're so appreciative of these few minutes we have with you, but what do you say to people who say, why didn't you talk more about your observations? Why didn't Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, Ashley Judd, who did do a Vanity Fair piece a while back but didn't name him, why didn't more people talk about this?
Well, look, for a start, I never saw it. Let's be clear about that. I never did see it, nor did he ever behave.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I never saw the harassments, nor did he ever behave in that way to me. Otherwise, I would have been out the door and extremely noisy about it. So I never actually experienced it or saw it. We did hear rumors of it, but, you know, we didn't. There are rumors about many people, and, you know, one just didn't see it. You know, a lot of this stuff took place in after hours, you know, in restaurants, bars, Cannes Film Festival.
Well,
you know,
it would be dangerous.
Overseas.
It'd be dangerous to talk about it. I mean, you write that the Miramax deals that you witnessed with Harvey Weinstein sounded like wiretap transcripts of mobster John Gotti. He was that intimidating.
Well, you know, he's a very scary man, and he knows that he's scary, actually. And the flip side of it is he's enormously charming. And this is what was a difficult thing for those who experienced the good side of Harvey. And I did experience both, absolutely. You know, that he's a man of enormous taste and skill when it comes to making movies. His extraordinary sense of what is good and what is excellent. And then at the same time, there is this other side. It's a kind of Beauty and the Beast that cohabits in one being. And I sometimes felt that the sort of conflict in him about the fact that he was really such a kind of deeply intimidating and almost gross individual, but with a very refined sensibility when it came to taste. I think these things were at war in him and actually created a lot of dissonance and rage, probably, in the way he comported himself.
Well, we should say that Harvey Weinstein has released a statement denying that he ever had non-consensual sex or that he took away work from people if they didn't consent to sex.
I do have to say, though, anyone who hears that tape, I think it leaves you in no doubt. This was a very unhappy girl, a very unwilling girl, a girl who was protesting. And he was not taking no for an answer.
Editor Tina Brown formerly edited the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, her new platform, Live, Tina Brown Live Media, Women in the World. Tina, thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Here and Now.